I have the privilege of introducing all of those things to you. It's more than a new series. We're also presenting our values as a church, but it's also being labeled a project. So for the lack of a better way of coming up with a title, I decided to make it the longest possible title, Changing Our Default Setting, Annual Life Transformation Project, Part 1. So to make it as long as possible to give it that heaviness and weight, okay? So let's read with me John 17, 15 through 19. It kind of gives me the background, the backbone to my understanding of who we are and our identity as Christians and Christ followers, and over against the differences that is to be found in our lives over against others in the world. And Jesus, in his final prayer, his priestly prayer for his disciples, says this. And says, "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, Lord," to his Father, "but that you protect them from the evil one here in this earth," he's saying. "They are not of the world, even as I am not of it, but sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. For them I sanctify myself, that they too may be truly sanctified." This passage gets shortened many times, as we are called to be in the world, but not to be of the world. We're sent, however, to be part of the world as well. Now, I want to start off by talking about values. If I were to ask you, and in fact, I will ask you right now to think a little bit about the values that drive your life. Narrow that down just a little bit and see if that might be helpful. Think about some of the values that drive your life, or the values that drive your workplace. Think about some of the values that drive your workplace and be honest about it. What are some of the values that drive your workplace? Anybody have an idea? Profit. It's a basic one, but sometimes nowadays a lot of businesses are almost afraid to say, really, the bottom line is the bottom line. And it's okay. Making money in and of itself is not a sin. What are some other values? Maybe some of you guys have a value in your workplace of honesty and integrity. You have an expectation. I'm not being, you know, sarcastic about that. Hard work might be your work value. I believe in hard work. It drives me nuts when my coworker cuts corners and I just can't do it that way, you know. And your wife or your husband might be complaining, saying, "Oh, you work so hard for what?" And you're hard at work because that's just who you are. That's part of your work value. Think about your values that drive your life. Think about some of the values that drive your life personally. Think of one or two, and you could even write that down. Or in fact, tell the person next to you if you would, especially if you don't know that person. Especially if you know that person. Tell them some of the values that drive your life. One or two values that's important to you. Everybody have values, right? Healthy living. I believe in healthy living. Integrity is important to me. Compassion is important to me. Yeah. Good food is a value to me. Now, how would I know if these values were real? Just because you said it? Just because you said it? I've never met a person who has said, "Integrity is not a value to me." Bernie Madoff has said, "I have never willingly cheated anyone in my life." You know, and you go, okay, billions of dollars, but you believe you're a man of integrity. And he will say, yes. Kenneth Lay, the CEO of Enron, says he had no idea these things were happening. when Enron was cheating and scamming and cooking their books and all that stuff. How would I know that these values are real to you? Because you say it? No. Your values are important, and they do have a way in which they drive your life, but they are measured by your life. They're measured not simply by statements. Statements are important, but they're measured also by your life action. Dangers, there are tremendous dangers of having values that are mainly words. The tremendous dangers of having values that are only statements that you put up on the wall by which you don't, do anything other than to say we all need to memorize it. We all need to say that this is an important thing to us. We say it's important thing to us, and we can say values are an important thing to me. Honesty, integrity, all these things can be important to me. And you can say this, and you can really believe this, and your life may not reflect it, right? We have to look at your life. Jesus is telling us that we Christians are in the world, but not of the world. Is Jesus saying that we're some sort of aliens, strange beings? Is that his point? No, it's not his point. He's saying, no, you guys are obviously human beings. You guys are all God's creation, but you're in the world in a very different way. There are some different values that drive your life, and it must be part of your every being and fiber. You must be driven by this, just as I have been driven by them. You will be separated from the world, set aside from the world, and one says, by how you live, as it reflects God's glory, my life. Jesus tells us we have different values. We're in the world, but not of the world. And I think it's important for us to make statements about values, but we also need to make statements about, we also need to have a plan or some sort of a process by which we will say, how will we know? How will we look at each other and say, is this really being acted out in our lives? There's been studies done over and over that tells us that sometimes stating that you have a value can actually blind you. You will create a blind spot in your life to how your life is not following that value, because you'll say, well, I'm a man of integrity. It's my value. I've written it down. I've taken a vow. I've signed things that says I will behave as a man of integrity. Therefore, you accusing me of doing something that is not honest, that goes against my integrity, that cannot even be possible. So we have these blind spots. So I present this to you because as I am just about to present to you our values for our coming year, because it is that important that we make these statements, not just words, but rather that they become something that we live out. So one of the things that we want to do, Pastor Sam and I was struggling with, when do I present these values? And I just said, I'm just going to present it at the very beginning, even if we don't fully appreciate it. This is what we're going to do throughout, not just this Sunday, but throughout the year, to really reflect on these values becoming ingrained in our bones, deep in our hearts. And I want to say that these are the values that we see as fundamental to what it means, that we see and we agree upon as to what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a church that follows and glorifies and praises God. And it's very, very simple and straightforward. And you'll see why these are values to us. And you'll see these aren't like fantastically, like, you're not going to go, wow, I never thought about those things as values. That's so cool. It has never occurred to me. Because if it's something like that, then it's like, strange that we would come up with something that you never heard of, right? So these are going to be things that you'll just say is like, I can't even understand how that would get looked at. But we present these values in one part to say, now we want to really do a good job this coming year stating these values and looking at ourselves to make sure that we're living by these values. That's the difference in this value statement that I would like to emphasize. And without further ado, I want to just present to you the values. And it's very, very simple that Cross Community Church, we'll start off by being, we will focus on being God-centered. This is one of the ways in which we're in the world, but not of the world. Because of the world is to say, we're me-centered, right? At the end of the day, the purpose of my life is to make sure that I'm doing well, to look out for me, right? That's the world values. And there's nothing in itself, there's nothing, you know, it sounds like I'm really putting it down. I'm just trying to contrast it versus saying the Christian life is simply to say we're God-centered. We're God-centered. I'm not trying to get into relationships and situations so that people revolve around me. People are I'm center of other people's lives. That's not the point of my life anymore. But rather, my question will be to ask, how can my life be always be centered around God, who God is? The second value is going to be very simple as well, is that my life at Cross Community Church, we want to be about exalting Christ. We want to be Christ exalting. And that contrasts with the world's values. That the world exalts success. Not when Christ is exalted, but when you're exalted. And we want to look at all the different ways in which we look at our own lives, and we find so much need and desire and pleasure, and we seek approval and applause of other people. And we find the measure of our lives not in which, not at the end of the day, we come back and many of us, we do not say, is Christ exalted in what I did today? But rather we say, you know, How am I doing? That was a successful day. I got a lot of, you know, good jobs. People are looking at me and thinking that I'm really, really cool. There's a lot of acclaim involved in the me-centered, me-exalting world. And the third thing, third value for us to emphasize is that we want to be spirit empowered. That the Spirit Himself is the one who gives us just strength. Versus the world's value says it's going to be about my ability to control situations. So if I don't have control over a situation, it's going to be something that I have to try to remedy by trying to get more power, more control, more ways in which I can will myself or change this setting so that I can control and take away as much unpredictable, uncontrollable things as possible. Now, if these things seem kind of like really broad and like huge and you go, what are the implications of this? I understand. And in fact, I just want to leave it there. This sermon is not to, you know, talk about these things in detail, but is to simply present it to you and say, this is what we're going to be working on, and this is going to be obviously on a major scale as we present it to you today, and that we want to spend several months and talking about it as well as the entire year living this out. Different implications of this, and we want you to be part of that conversation, because we believe when this happens is that we find true life transformation, which is what we believe as the next value, is that our church has to be life transforming. Life has to be different, the way we live it in the world. Community has to be different, and it must change in this world. I call this the annual life transformation project. We'll leave that for now, and because to emphasize that it is going to be a year-long journey, annual, obviously, that's what that means. Life, to emphasize that this is all life, community life, personal life, all life-encompassing, and not just to separate it into this category that the Bible doesn't understand as spiritual life, as this narrow category, narrow strata of experience that we experience on Sundays, and sometimes in small groups, and sometimes when we do quiet times. That's not what this is about, but rather this is about all of life. Transformation, and that it is dealing with a process of change by which we go from point A to point B, individually, but also as a community, as cross-community church. And that there will be a way that we will look at the way in which we're daring to say that we're looking and desiring to see actual change that we can see and observe both in ourselves and in others. And project, to emphasize that this will be an actual practice, stuff that we do versus stuff that we walk out and just say, well, that's kind of interesting, you know, and just, you know, that's inspiring. Not just changing our thinking, not just emotional inspiration, but that we're going to be at work and will have to be done thoughtfully and skillfully. Now, all of this is based on the assumptions that the basic desire, that there is a basic desire in all of us for authentic transformation in our lives. We could actually turn this off for now. To be authentically transformed. And I want to talk today about these two words a bit. To be authentically transformed. And I want to focus on that for the rest of my message. Authenticity and transformation. Now, authenticity is something real, something deep and genuine, not just on a superficial level, but something that cuts across all of the layers, but that gets into the reality as it really is sometimes. And to have that be a deep, meaningful transformation in our lives. So one of the things that we're saying, you know, we're talking about in terms of, you know, we don't want this to be a year-long, like a dieting project, where after the year of dieting, you know, we go back to our own ways. You know, we go back to our old ways of just, you know, whatever, you know, just eating after 9 o'clock and midnight snacks and those kind of things and say, oh, we're just going to try really hard for a year. That's not what this is about. This is about authentic and genuine transformation. We want it to be deeply authentic. We want it to be deeply transforming. So let me talk about those two words a little bit. Let me talk about authenticity a little bit. Esther and I just came back from a brief vacation, a trip to Alaska, which was like the last state. Some of you guys are like, Alaska? And did somebody clap just now? No. Which was for me this beautiful, breathtaking place. You know, I hate using the word surreal because it's overused, but I'll say surreal because, you know, you're staying there. The days are like 20 hours long. You know, there's light out at 10:30, 11 o'clock. And my entire dieting plan of, you know, don't eat after the sun goes down, it just goes out the door. I'm like, well, the sun's still out. You know, I'm just still having steak at 10 o'clock at night. You know, who eats steak at 10 o'clock at night around here? But in Alaska, you can. You know, this is one of those last breathtaking places of wilderness where civilization butts against wilderness in a way that I've not encountered before. And there's something deeply authentic about the encounter with nature and wildlife that you experienced there that I didn't think that I would love as much. Our very first hike, we got off the bus and we did this short hike next to the highway on our way to the hotel. We ran into a gigantic moose and a calf. And it was just, you know, it was just mind-blowing. I was just like, wow, is that for real? And the moose kind of just looked. And the moose, I don't know if you've ever seen a real-life moose head that's actually attached to a body. And it's just this gigantic. And it just looked at me. and was eating these berries, and something deep within me said, wow, this is not a zoo. This is not Disneyland. This is not something made up. This is a real life experience. There was no fence. I had this one morning to myself, and I decided to experience wilderness the way I normally enjoy doing. As many of you guys know, I rented a mountain bike, and I went riding on this trail that was right next to the hotel. I went toward this river where I was told that you could see salmon, you know, Alaskan salmon swimming, they're spawning. And you have to use this hand-cranked tram to cross this river. And I'm just thinking, this is the coolest thing. And the guy's explaining to me how I have to put my bike on the hand tram, put it across, and then, you know, get back, bring it back, and then you cross the river. I'm just going, this is so cool. This is so cool. I gotta read up on this on Bear Grylls or something. You know, I gotta get my knife or something. You know, this is survival man kind of a situation. And at one point, I saw these bear paw prints, really. And it wasn't like fake. It was real bear paw prints. It looked like bear paw prints, I know. Okay. And there were other signs, shall we say, of the bear's presence. You know? Lots of berries. They eat lots of berries. And I'm seeing these glacial peaks, more than fear, more than awe. I had this sense of being really deeply connected. This is God's creation. I'm like starting to sing to myself, you know, Lord of all creation. No. Heavens are your temple. Okay. Now, just at that moment, I hear this noise. And it's coming from something really close. Okay. And it's like right behind me. And I realize, wait, it's not right behind me. It's right next to me. In fact, my pants are singing. And my phone is ringing in the middle of this wilderness because my wife Esther is calling me and I'm getting 4 bars. And it just totally ruined this real, authentic wilderness moment for me. But it was this hunger. I realized it was this hunger to have this encounter, a deep, real encounter with reality. An encounter with God is encounter with reality, bar none. There is something in us that longs for experiences that say, this is real. This is not made up. This is not man-made. This is life. And this happens not just in the woods of Alaska, but whenever our hearts are able to discern something deep and something unfathomably real, it's like this crazy cosmic caffeine that jolts you into seeing things clearly and awakens you from a half-awake, slumbering walk that you've been going through in your entire life. And part of what it means to be a Christian, part of what it means to what we confess and experience is that there's nothing more real, there's nothing more authentic than to see God and to find our lives enfolded in the life of God Himself. True encounter with God doesn't take us out of reality, but rather it puts reality in a sort of a HD focus that you didn't think was possible before. So I believe that this authenticity hunger is deep within all of us. And I believe that this is something that we long and desire. And especially when we encounter it, we know this is life. This is true. This is something that I can put everything aside to pursue in my life. You know, this is the kind of a thing that, you know, when you're having these sort of experiences, this is a kind of a moment where you go, now, how many hours did I spend last week thinking about when the new iPhone 5 will come out? And you just go, that's just, how much was I stressing because things were not in order at my workplace? I'm not saying that we just kind of neglect all of these things, but it puts into this stark focus, right? Encounter with authenticity. The second part is transformation. Encounter with the authentic, with the real, doesn't just end there. It doesn't just become a nice, wow, that was really cool sort of a moment, but it starts a process of transformation and change. This is how Paul describes it in 2 Corinthians 3. It says, we who with unveiled faces all reflect, with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory. Ever-increasing glory. Not all glory all at once, but ever-increasing glory, a process which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. So we start off, the image is something like that. We start off becoming a mirror, a reflection. Josh, in his prayer, talked about reflecting who God is in our lives. And that's a very biblical understanding, that we become sort of a mirror to Jesus. And Christ's glory is reflected, and we become more like him. And this is what the Holy Spirit makes possible. And all of us, if we call ourselves Christian, have experienced this, right? On one level or another, we have experienced this. There was a point at which when you first encountered Christ authentically, and it began a process of transformation. A lot of people admire Jesus, but something happened when you met him for real in this untamed, undistorted image of who Jesus is, and it became real to you, and you said, this is it. This is what I've been longing for my entire life, without even knowing, without even being able to name it. I am going to follow him. I would rather have this man and give up everything else in the world. And I would pay any price because it would be more than worth it. I will go wherever he wants me to go, whatever he wants me to do, give whatever he says I ought to give. Today, my world is no longer centered around me and my needs and my desires. No, my deepest longing is to serve him as he takes his rightful place at the center. May my life be a reflection of his glory. On one level or another, this is the confession of every Christian. Right? Right? And since then, look, all of us, I think, have something which we can say, I was like this, but since meeting Christ, I am like this now. There has been transformation, and I want to affirm that. People say, you know, look, I had zero sense of compassion on others, but now I feel compassion. I do feel love for others. Some other people will say, I was a money-grubbing penny pincher, but now I know the joy of giving. Others will say I was a habitual liar and a cheat. But I now stake my life on the truth that releases me, that fidelity and truthfulness is my desire to live out in all of my relationships. To varying degrees, Christians are people who have experienced authentic transformation, and Christ is reflected. But look, something else has happened along the way, right? Because this is all good. This is all good. We all desire authentic transformation. We all have experienced authentic transformation on one level or another and different aspects of our lives. But something has happened along the way. We say we desire, we cry when we encounter it, but far too often we settle for something far, far less. And in a moment of clarity, we look at our lives, and it's a far cry from the glory of God that's being reflected. Somewhere along the way, the transformation has stalled. And that's the truth too, isn't it? And the worst part about the transformation stalling in our lives is that many of us don't even feel that badly about it. It might be because of all the conforming pressures in the world that the Bible talks about. It might be because of our own sinfulness that we settle for inauthentic transformation and settle for superficial markers of pseudo-spirituality that aren't particularly painful or costly or doesn't require sacrifice. Whatever the reason, many of us have become cynical to the possibility of authentic transformation occurring regularly and in a real way in our lives. And after a while, we become set in our ways. It doesn't matter if you're in your 20s, 30s, or 40s, or even older than that, possibly. And we become set in our ways. That's just how I am, we say. That's just how I am. What's the point of even trying? We become cynical about ourselves, and here's what happens when you become cynical about your own transformation in the church. You start becoming cynical. The way we justify our own cynicism is that we start becoming cynical about others' transformation. We say, well, the other people are not being transformed really either. They're only going to this level. Why do I have to worry about going to this level when everybody else is here in the shallow end? We become cynical as a community. We long for authentic transformation, but we settle for something less. How are we going to get out of this? Paul says, look, transformation occurs when you offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God, and be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And this way, we live out His will, God's will. Our bodies, our minds, our will, every aspect of human life Paul is talking about. And he says, transforming, it is transformed when we bring it to God in worship, and our minds are renewed. Renewed. Renewed, Paul says, not in the sense of just kind of like, just try again. Renewed, not in the sense of kind of like, you know, what I did to renew my driver's license a little while back. You know, you just kind of just say, oh, it's just a process. They just want more fees. You know, hopefully they'll update my picture. Maybe not. You know, and it's just renewed. Not like that. But renew. Something starkly fundamental has to happen. We want to pursue as a church, look, in the coming year, core changes, fundamental changes. We want to change, as Pastor Sam likes to say, our default setting to how we pursue God in our lives. Listen, when most of you guys hear stuff about change, and most of you guys hear stuff about how to become different, when you hear something in service and you become inspired in service to change, maybe you thought a little while back, you know, I talked a little bit about, you know, doing stuff with greater patience, understand your life in terms of God's timing, right? That's what I said 2 weeks ago in my message. Chase those kids away. No. Hey, you kids, I'm always scared of somebody saying, get out of my yard. Okay, so I grew up with that. Where was I? Okay, so patience, right? How many of you guys have heard messages on patience? What is our general process by which we think about patience? We try to develop greater patience in our lives. We walk away feeling inspired and saying, yeah, you know, I need to be more patient. Because you go through all of the things in your life where you go, man, I was really impatient. Maybe you honked at somebody in the church parking lot. You know, maybe you were just like, you know, you got a traffic ticket speeding. I've gotten a traffic ticket speeding to church. You know, it's just an awful, it ruins your day. You know, it's like, oh, man, you know. And, but then, you know, somebody preaches them on patience and you go, oh, I need to drive slower. You know, all these things happen. It's fresh in your mind, and you go through the week. What do you try to do? You go, okay, I'm going to try to be more patient, and I'm going to try harder. And you're at the Costco line, and you go, okay, that guy has lots of stuff, and he's going to write a check. And he's not even going to let the check machine do it. He wants to write it himself because he doesn't trust the check machine. Why? You know, and you start, you go, okay, but I'm going to be patient, right? Or, you know, maybe I just started doing laundry again. So I find myself, I'm like, why does it take so long for my pants to dry? And you're like, no, I'm not going to yell at machines because I'm going to practice patience. I'm not going to honk at the guy when the guy doesn't go on the first nanosecond of the green. I'm going to be more patient. How does that work out for you guys? Works out okay for those little things. Little things, when we try harder, we realize the ridiculousness of and the folly of our ways. But the meaningful things, being patient with our kids. My wife and I, we take turns putting down our kids, and we actually kind of fight to see who puts down Lucy, because we both want to put down Lucy versus Max, because Max takes like 45 minutes to put down. Go to sleep! You know, there's a point at which you move again. You know, and we're like practically threatening. We don't care all the parental instincts about what's a good parent goes on. It's just, you know, after 45 minutes of this kid squirming, it kind of, you know, all that patience that you had. Okay, Max, now let's go to sleep now. This is what psychologists tell. This is the latest study. I heard this on the radio recently. When you're being patient in one situation, you know what happens to most of us? We have a patience quota for the day, right? So you're patient with your kids, and then you take it out on your spouse. How many people know this? hello, okay. you're patient, and you go at your workplace, you go, I'm going to be really patient with my customers. And you become really short with your coworkers, right? Or you kick the dog. Well, I don't know. I mean, we have a patience. I don't have a dog. I don't even have a dog. I wouldn't ever kick a dog. I'm a little bit scared of dogs. You know, you wouldn't ever. Your patience doesn't grow that way. We're just fooling ourselves in any meaningful things of trying harder. It's like, you know, every year. Right? How many of us have the same New Year's resolutions 20 years running? I'm going to read the Bible every day this year. Give it up, you know? Forget it. Just say, look, God, forgive me. No, I'm going on a diet and lose 5 pounds. Next year, 7 pounds. The year after that, it's just like, just a pound, please. And like eventually you get into your 40s and you're just like, please help me to just grow by just 1 pound only. I'm trying harder. Everything will tell you is just ridiculous. All of our experience. And this is what we do in the church with our spiritual practices. You learn and you try hard to be patient. You try harder to be happy. I gave a message on happiness a little while back. You know how hard it is to just say, I'm going to try harder to be happy? Impossible. It requires a fundamental change. A fundamental change. Biblical understanding of patience, happiness, all of these things is not just that you try harder, but that you have a different perspective. And we get at it differently through disciplines. And disciplines is never understood in the Bible as personal, individual. It's always community. It's something where there is always accountability. Why? Because we have blind spots on our blind spots. We have blind spots that make us think we're never as bad as we really are. And the second part is we need to address our defaults. We need to address our defaults. Our default settings of behavior. Let me get at this really quickly, and this is the last point that I really have to make. But Daniel Ariely is a behavioral economist, behavioral scientist, and he writes some fantastic stuff. And his online blog has this question and answer thing. And the question is, what's wrong with the experience of online dating? Anybody want an answer to that? Just curious. Some people might be like, I know, it sounds like there's nothing wrong. Okay, no. Sorry. But he says this. He said, for the most part, I think that online dating, and let me get at this, and you'll see my point, I think, because we need to understand what default settings are in our lives. I think that online dating is an incredibly unsatisfying experience. In fact, when we do surveys to understand what people do, the basic trade-off is for each 6 hours of searching for people and emailing them, you get one cup of coffee. And it's not as if people enjoy online dating. It's not as if people have fun searching people and writing blurbs for them. I mean, imagine that you basically have to drive 6 hours, 3 hours each way, to have a coffee with somebody. And you know, coffee usually ends up with just coffee. It's an incredibly unsatisfying experience. So I think it's a really bad, system. On top of that, there's another thing in which I imagine I gave you, the search criteria, which I asked you to search by height and weight and income and all of those things, and you're going to use it. And that's what I give you to search, and that's what you're going to use to eliminate all of your potentials. There's a million people out there, and you want to limit them to 3,000. And that's what we're going to do. That's what you're going to use. And because of that, I think people actually become more superficial than we actually are, than we actually think we think they are. So here's an example. It turns out women really care about men's height. I'm 5'9". If I wanted to be attractive as somebody who's 5'10", right, what's so bad about writing another inch? I would have to make about 35,000 to 40,000 more a year. That's a lot of money for 1 inch to compensate. This is what the data shows. At the same time, it turns out that men care a lot about women's BMIs, body mass index. In fact, they want women to be slightly anorexic at like 18 and a half BMI. 18.5% BMI. And you look at women's attractiveness, it goes up at low BMI and really drops below that. Now, people online look really superficial. And this is not, he's not espousing this. He's saying this is what happens when you limit the criteria and the search defaults are based on looks, heights, and these kind of things. But we have to have a certain way in which we need to eliminate, you know, millions of people. I don't say this. And you can ask, because that's all people care about, or is that because that's what the system is giving them to search for? And I think, at least in part, it's because of the combination. Many of us have been taught that there are certain ways in which we ought to think about certain situations in life that's deeply, deeply ingrained, and those are our defaults. And when we struggle with issues, when we make decisions, those become our default activities. We don't even know that we're making decisions based in our marriages. We don't even know that we're making decisions based more on power and control and how to get things my way and how to get this household to revolve around me, rather than to say, how do I let the glory of God be reflected in this place? Most of us don't know that we have all these relationships and friendships that's centered around these default understanding of what friendship is. How do I get this person to like me? How do I get this person to approve of me? Rather than what true friendships, somebody that the Bible understands is somebody who pushes one another. No wonder, I really want to say, no wonder we're so scared to death. And we talked about this a little bit on men's group, and that we're so scared to death of holding one another accountable to certain things. We're so scared to death with our friends to bring up certain issues, because we think friendship is meant to be somebody we give complete and just blank check approval to. Those are our defaults. And it goes into how we understand our careers. It goes into how we understand and raise our kids. Are they truly a gift of God? Are they really gods? Or has somebody that you try to mold after your image? How does transformation occur? We need to address those defaults. And we get those defaults addressed when we go through and a long, committed, accountable, community-wide practice by which we can talk to each other about how we're doing. We can engage with one another and ask of one another, how is God being centered in your life? Broad stroke. Hopefully you're getting some of where we're getting at, and we're going to spend a lot of time explaining every one of these things. We want to talk about some of the practices in the coming weeks really, really soon. But one of the things that we want to start off is to talk about how we understand our Sabbath, our time together, because it's a real simple one, and it's really something that we can all do together without feeling a whole lot of like pressure to begin with. But at the same time, I think it's something by which we say, what is our default understanding of what church is supposed to be? Are we here as audience? Are we here as, or something else? That's what we want to address. That's what we want to talk about when we say it's God-centered, Christ-exalting, Spirit-empowered, and life-transforming. And when all of these come together, I believe there will be authentic transformation. I want to invite Pastor Sam to lead us in a time of communion now.